Welcome to the White Paper. This isn't just another tech podcast. This is where we pull back the curtain on emerging technology and blockchain, where we don't just talk about the future, we break it down before it happens. I'm your host, Nicklin Decker, a venture capitalist out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. But before that, I was the guy in the shadows investigating corporate fraud, embezzlement, and intellectual property theft for Fortune 500 companies. For over 17 years, I tracked hidden assets, exposed fraud rings, and worked alongside federal agencies, district attorneys, vice units, and more, all in the pursuit of the truth. And that's what this podcast is about, truth. In the White Paper, we cut through all the noise, break down blockchain, and make sense of the tech that's changing our world. No jargon, no hype, just real conversations about how emerging technology is impacting business, finance, and everyday life. I'm here to bring clarity where there's confusion and to speak in plain truth, because in Oklahoma, we say what we mean and we mean what we say. So buckle up. The future's coming fast. Let's make sense of it together. This is a special and unique episode. One that I am truly honored to present. In this episode, I've been commissioned, in a way, to relay a message. Today, I will be pulling back the curtain on Bitcoin and its future, revealing the truth without the noise, without the FOMO, just pure clarity on how Satoshi Nakamoto's vision has been distorted by traditional institutions and governments. This is your Clarion call. So buckle up and enjoy the ride. Let's rewind to 2008, when the global financial system collapsed, exposing the deep flaws of centralized banking. Lehman Brothers fell, which triggered a domino effect across global economies, and then the governments bailed out banks while ordinary citizens suffered job losses, inflation, and foreclosures. The public trust in centralized finance shattered at that moment in time. The root cause? Uncontrolled financial speculation, reckless lending, and systemic mismanagement. Banks and financial institutions packaged bad loans into complex securities, disguising their risk. When homeowners defaulted on their mortgages, the entire system unraveled, leading to one of the worst financial crises in history. But then came Bitcoin. On October 31st, 2008, an anonymous figure or collective, Satoshi Nakamoto, emerged from the shadows, declaring, "Chancellor, on brink of second bailout for banks." Nakamoto published the White Paper. It was titled, "Bitcoin, a Peer-to-Peer Electronic Cash System." Now, this just wasn't another financial product. It was a completely new monetary system designed to eliminate reliance on banks and central authorities, the same ones that our trust was just shattered with. For the first time, a financial system could function without middlemen. No banks approving transactions, no governments controlling supply, no Wall Street firms manipulating value. Instead, Bitcoin introduced a decentralized, trustless system where transactions were verified by a network of independent participants rather than a central authority. Bitcoin was programmed scarce, meaning no central entity could print more coins like governments print money. The total supply was fixed at, and is fixed at, 21 million Bitcoin. It was and is immutable, meaning it's unchangeable. Bitcoin was meant to be a decentralized hedge against central banks, a break from Wall Street control, and financial sovereignty for individuals. So now let's fast forward to today. Bitcoin has never been more loved, has never been bigger, but it's also never been more controlled. By control, we see in Cyprus 2013, banks froze deposits and implemented a bail-in where customer savings were seized to stabilize the banking system. If Bitcoin had been mainstream, at that time, people could have protected their wealth from government confiscation. Then we see Venezuela in 2016, hyperinflation rendered the national currency worthless. Bitcoin became a financial lifeline, allowing citizens to escape the failing economy and conduct international transactions. And then in 2021, the government banned cryptocurrency transactions, yet Bitcoin peer-to-peer networks flourished, proving what we thought, its resilience against authoritarian control. So what does this all this mean? The less control people have over their own money, the more vulnerable they are to financial crises. Bitcoin was designed as a solution to that problem. But has it stayed true to our vision? Has it been absorbed into the very system it was meant to disrupt? So as you see, as Bitcoin's value grew, it caught the attention of the very institutions it was designed to disrupt. What was started as a decentralized revolution is now at risk of becoming just another asset in the hands of the financial elite. Here's the truth. Institutions don't enter markets unless they can control them or profit from them. And now we're seeing both. Bitcoin, once was the cypherpunk dream, it's now in the hands of Wall Street. So how did this happen? Where did the plan and all this go wrong? What we remember is the people shouted. They cried after the financial system collapsed. We want a solution. Give us a solution. But instead of seeing Bitcoin for what it was, a decentralized monetary system, they saw it for what they wanted it to be. Money, not freedom. Through hype and FOMO, celebrities and influencers, they fueled this narrative that overshadowed its true purpose. Now, some argue that institutional adoption brings legitimacy, liquidity, and mainstream accessibility to Bitcoin. But at what cost? Bitcoin was created to be a decentralized, borderless alternative to traditional finance, a currency that cannot be controlled by governments, banks, or institutional investors. But as Bitcoin's value grew, so did the interest of the very institution it sought to erupt. Now, here's the core issue. Bitcoin's decentralized nature relied on widely distributed ownership and validation across the network. In its early days, Bitcoin was mined and traded by individuals, developers, and cypherpunks who understood its ethos, its core values, its mandate, its mantra. But today, a growing percentage of Bitcoin is held by institutions, hedge funds, and publicly traded ETFs. Now, as we all see, Bitcoin ETFs are often framed as making Bitcoin more accessible. But in reality, they shift the control from the individuals to institutions, from decentralized to centralized. Owning ETF shares isn't the same as holding Bitcoin. You're just leasing exposure to an asset that's meant to be trustless. BlackRock, Fidelity, and Grayscale now control massive Bitcoin reserves, meaning they are not individual holders. Who's supposed to set the rules? Some claim that institutional adoption brings legitimacy.
But ask yourself, legitimacy at what cost? ETFs don't empower investors. They empower the financial giants to dictate Bitcoin's future, just as they did with gold. If you can't withdraw it, self-custody it, or spend it freely, do you really own it? So when financial giants control Bitcoin, they don't do it for decentralization. They do it for control, because with control comes profits. Bitcoin ETFs don't give people financial sovereignty. They give Wall Street an even bigger deciding role in Bitcoin's future. Now again, some might argue that Bitcoin ETFs still allow you to withdraw your Bitcoin, but history, it tells us otherwise. Let's look at the precedent here. When gold ETFs took over, redemption policies were slowly phased out. Banks will always find a way to discourage withdrawals through fees, restrictions, and regulations. Bitcoin's no different. BlackRock, Fidelity, and Grayscale aren't adopting Bitcoin because they believe in self-sovereign money. They're adopting it because they see a chance to control liquidity, dictate regulation, and profit off of retail investors. That's the people that are supposed to be controlling Bitcoin, the retail investors. The illusion of accessibility is just that. It's an illusion. Owning shares of an ETF is not the same thing as owning Bitcoin. If you can't withdraw it, self-custody it, or spend it freely, do you really own it? Or are you just leasing exposure to an asset that's supposed to be trustless? Now, this isn't just about financial adoption. It's about control. The more control institutions have over Bitcoin supply, the less decentralized it becomes. Now, the question has come up. Does institutionalization, does it mean centralization? Now, decentralization isn't just about who holds Bitcoin. It's also about who validates transactions and maintains the network. We've already seen institutions tighten their grip on Bitcoin through ETFs and custodial holdings, but let's discuss something even more concerning to us. Bitcoin flash crashes and the role of leveraged liquidations and market manipulation. Now, we've seen it all. Bitcoin's holding steady, and then suddenly within minutes, it plummets, a flash crash. But here's the real question. Are these crashes natural market behavior, or are they engineered? So let's break this down. What is a flash crash? How does it happen? Now, to set the tone here, you have to understand Bitcoin operates in a highly liquid yet fragile market where price swings can be extreme. Some corrections are natural, caused by macro events, risk-off sentiment, or over-leveraged traders getting liquidated. But what if I told you some crashes don't just happen, they're created? So, you want to know how that happens? It's a five-step process. The setup, the trap, the trigger, the cascade. Finally, the buyback. The setup includes institutions and large traders. You have to understand, they don't just react to the market, they move the market. Their liquidity, the amount of money they hold, moves the market. So before a crash, we often see massive amounts of Bitcoin being moved onto exchanges. Why? Because whales aren't selling in the crash. They're selling before the crash. Then you got step two, the trap. Picture this. Retail investors are all hyped by celebrities, influencers. You've got people all over the place. You've got CEOs pushing this. They're all hyping. They're all rallying behind Bitcoin, cheering Bitcoin's name. And Bitcoin's price is climbing and leverage is high. Many traders have placed long positions using borrowed funds, expecting Bitcoin to keep rising. And institutions know this. Then comes the third step, the trigger. At the right moment, large players start placing massive sell orders, draining liquidity from the market. This forces the price down, triggering stop losses and liquidations of over-leveraged traders. And then you see the dominoes begin to fall, which leads into step four, the cascade. As leverage positions collapse, it automatically forces more sell orders, accelerating the crash. What was once a small dip becomes a full-blown liquidation event, which then leads into step five, the buyback. Now, here's where it gets interesting. After retail traders are wiped out, the same institutions that triggered the crash start buying back Bitcoin at a discount. They're profiting on both sides of what Nakamoto created. They're shorting the market before the crash, betting on the price going down, and then buying back at rock bottom prices once the crash is over. This isn't hypothetical. Look at May 19th, 2021. It's flash crash. Bitcoin's price collapsed 30% in a single day, wiping out $8 billion in leveraged positions. But in all that, here's what most people missed. Glassnode data showed that large Bitcoin holders moved massive amounts of Bitcoin onto exchanges before the crash. The market depth weakened as institutional trading desks pulled liquidity, meaning that there were fewer buy orders to absorb the drop. The result? A cascading sell-off that triggered the largest one-day liquidation event in Bitcoin history. So, who benefits from these crashes? Not retail traders. Not the individual decentralized holders that support the ethos of Bitcoin. No. The winners are the same players who profit from market volatility. Whales and institutional traders, they can manipulate the market by controlling supply and liquidity. The exchanges and market makers. Liquidations mean more trading fees, and some exchanges have even been accused of pausing withdrawals during major crashes. And then high-frequency trading firms. Companies like Jump Trading and Cumberland use algorithms to predict and exploit market swings. So as we look at this, we're asking ourselves, what does this mean for Bitcoin's future? If institutions continue to control liquidity, flash crashes may not just be random market events. They could become a tool for price suppression and strategic accumulation. Now, we want to resonate this with everyone. Bitcoin was designed to be a decentralized, fair financial system. But if the same institutions that manipulated traditional markets now dictate Bitcoin's price action, have we really escaped the system? So next time Bitcoin suddenly crashes, ask yourself, who really benefits? Now, this isn't speculation. It's a pattern. Between 2021 and 2023, major exchanges like Binance, BitMEX, and Coinbase saw Bitcoin lose 30 to 50% of its value within hours. These weren't random drops. They followed the same institutional playbook. Massive Bitcoin inflows, liquidity manipulation, and cascading liquidations that wiped out retail investors. The question isn't just whether these crashes happen. It's why they keep happening. Who profits and what it means for Bitcoin's future? So we dug into more research. According to the Paris December Finance Meeting 2022, Bitcoin's May 19th, 2021 flash crash on Binance was exacerbated by large-scale liquidations and potential data manipulation. demonstrating how exchanges and institutional players can amplify market volatility. Additionally, a study published on ResearchGate analyzing flash crashes in crypto markets found that these events often follow a pattern of strategic liquidation initiated by who? Large whale holders or large holders and institutional traders. These actors intentionally push Bitcoin prices down, triggering a cascade of liquidations and highly leveraged positions. This creates a self-reinforcing cycle of forced sell-off and market chaos. The result? Well, we know the result. A market environment where Bitcoin's volatility can be weaponized, mirroring historical financial manipulation tactics seen in traditional markets. If institutions continue accumulating Bitcoin while exploiting leverage-based liquidations, it raises critical questions for us. First, they control the price. Next, they control the supply. That's exactly what's happening now with ETFs and custodial holdings, as financial giants quietly absorb more and more of Bitcoin's circulating supply. Market manipulation isn't just about forcing liquidations. It's about shaping Bitcoin's future through ownership. This isn't just about market volatility anymore. It's about the silent takeover of Bitcoin supply through custodial control, ETF accumulation, and the slow erosion of true decentralization. And that's what's happening as financial giants like BlackRock and Fidelity quietly absorb more of Bitcoin's liquidity through ETFs and custodial holdings. The reality is, price manipulation isn't just about short-term crashes. It's about long-term control over liquidity, supply, and regulation. And that's exactly what we're seeing with Bitcoin ETFs, custodial holdings, and financial giants like BlackRock quietly accumulating massive reserves. So what does this really mean for Bitcoin's future? Is Bitcoin still a decentralized asset, or is it becoming another tool in the hands of the financial giants? If institutions dominate mining operations, could they censor transactions? If large custodians control the majority of Bitcoin, can they influence liquidity and pricing? If governments regulate Bitcoin through institutions, will it undermine our very censorship resistance that we built? The future of Bitcoin depends on who holds it, who controls it, the people or the institutions. If you don't hold your Bitcoin, you don't own it. If you want to avoid institutional control, use self-custody. Hold your own keys. Use multi-sig wallets. Avoid custodial ETFs. Support decentralized exchanges. The more Bitcoin stays in the hands of the individuals, the harder it is to co-op. Now, we go back to look at the precedent, as they call it. In a court of law, it's a precedent. What happened before to build on today? And that precedent is the gold standard. Bitcoin is often called digital gold. But do we ever ask ourselves, what happened to physical gold? Gold was once a freely traded asset by individuals. Over time, central banks and ETFs absorbed most of the gold supply. Then governments abandoned the gold standard, and now individual ownership of gold has little effect on monetary policy. Just as governments absorbed most of the gold supply and moved away from the gold standard, institutional accumulation of Bitcoin could shift its power from individuals to financial giants, leaving everyday holders with little influence over its future. If Bitcoin follows this path, it could become a highly regulated asset rather than a decentralized currency. then enters national reserve assets. Governments talking about holding Bitcoin with billions, if not trillions of dollars, depending on the nation. But why would a country hold Bitcoin in reserves? The largest arguments that we see on the table right now is a hedge against inflation. Bitcoin, unlike fiat currency, has a fixed supply of 21 million Bitcoin and cannot be printed at will. This is how we designed it. This was Nakamoto's creation. But it also helps escape the US dollar dominance. Many economies rely on the dollar for trade, but Bitcoin offers a solution, an alternative that operates outside of traditional finance. Now, the third reason is protection from sanctions. Countries like Russia, Iran, and Venezuela have explored Bitcoin as a way to bypass Western-led financial restrictions. Now, the decentralization of this, of Bitcoin, how it was originally designed, how it hedged against inflation, how there was a fixed supply, and how it got everyone away from a fictitious currency as the US dollar. There was nothing backing it, the US dollar. So what are the risks of Bitcoin as a national reserve? Well, we've already seen countries like Russia and Iran explore Bitcoin to bypass sanction. If Bitcoin were to become a true reserve asset, similar economic warfare strategies could be used to destabilize nations reliant on it. This goes back to what we were just talking about, how institutions control the liquidity. They control how markets move. If nations use it as a national reserve, the same thing could happen. Now, this isn't some ethereal pipeline strategy. This actually mirrors economist and Nobel Prize-winning Paul Krugman's model on speculative attacks, where large players crash an asset's value through coordinated selling and shorting. Let's put this into context. Now, imagine a small nation. Let's call it Country X, that decides to adopt Bitcoin as a reserve asset or a primary currency. Let's say a large group of institutions or rival nations decide they don't like that, or they want something from the nation, or they want to influence or give undue influence on a nation. Well, there's three steps to this. Shorting the market, triggering a crash, and economic destabilization. Now, I've already said this mirrors a Nobel Prize winning economist. So follow as I take you through this. Shorting the market begins with powerful institutional players or state-backed entities shorting Bitcoin, again, betting on its price dropping, while simultaneously flooding the market with sell orders, creating an intense downward pressure. And then step two comes in, triggering a crash. Suddenly, a 30 to 50% price drop could wipe out a nation's Bitcoin reserves overnight, severely impacting its financial stability. And then the third step and final step of this economic destabilization is, if a country's wealth were disproportionately tied to Bitcoin, a manipulated crash could trigger a financial crisis more severe than traditional currency collapses, especially since Bitcoin lacks tangible assets to back its value. This tactic is known as an economic bomb or an econ bomb, a strategy resembling past market collapses such as 92's Black Wednesday, 97's Asian financial crisis, or 08's global financial crisis, all of which were driven by speculative attacks or financial manipulation. Now, if Bitcoin ever became a dominant reserve asset, major superpowers would find a way to control or destabilize its price. Governments could seize Bitcoin holdings through regulatory measures. Because remember, ETFs, they're controlled by institutions now. And who controls those institutions? They could encourage institutional accumulation to control Bitcoin's liquidity. They could outlaw or heavily tax self-custody to ensure only institutions control the supply. So, what's the takeaway from all this? Bitcoin's decentralization does make it powerful, but it's also its Achilles heel. Its openness also makes it vulnerable to market manipulation on a global scale. So as you see, Bitcoin is not just about freedom anymore, like Nakamoto originally designed it to be. It's about power. The moment nation states start accumulating Bitcoin, it stops becoming just a store of value and starts becoming a geopolitical asset, one that can shift global power dynamics, undermine traditional finance, and even shape international alliances. So what does this mean for the world? What does it mean for Bitcoin? Well, Bitcoin is forcing a conversation about the future of money. Will it remain a tool of financial freedom, or will governments and institutions absorb it into their systems? So to answer the question everyone is asking, did institutions kill Nakamoto's dream? Well, just like Oppenheimer, Nakamoto's equation for financial freedom has become the sum of all our fears. Thank you. Truly, I say it from the bottom of my heart, thank you for allowing me to be your tour guide on this special edition podcast. Because the sooner we understand the truth spoken, the better prepared we'll be. Now, do you have questions about Bitcoin? The white paper will be released on February 17th on Amazon. You'll find the link in the description. And do you have questions about blockchain, emerging technology, or how innovation can make life more efficient? Send me an email at thewhitepaper.io and let's find that answer together. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and stay informed. The world is changing and we are ready. Thanks for tuning in to this special episode. I will be here every Friday.